Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Susanna Morato. I'm the Vice President and Pro Vice Chancellor for Research here at the LSE. And it is a real pleasure to welcome you all to the Malaysia Theatre Auditorium for today's event hosted by the LSE European Institute. We are honoured to welcome Alexander Stubb, the 13th President of the Republic of Finland, who assumed office in March 2024. Finland is often admired internationally not only for its diplomacy but also for the strength of its institutions, education system and democratic culture. President Stubb has had an extraordinary career, spanning academia, European institutions, and national leadership. He has served as member of the European Parliament, Finland's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Minister for European Affairs and Foreign Trade, Prime Minister, and Minister of Finance. Before his election as President, he was Professor and Director of the School of Transnational Governance at the European University Institute in Florence. We are particularly delighted to welcome him back to LSE, where he completed his PhD in international relations, writing his doctoral thesis on flexible integration in the European Union. It is always a special moment when one of our alumni returns to the school, having helped shape international affairs at the highest level. Today, President Stubb will speak on rebalancing the new world order in the age of fragmentation. Following his remarks, we will open the floor to questions from the audience, where we will prioritize staff and student questions. President Stubb, it is a great pleasure to welcome you back to LSE. Please join me in welcoming President of the Republic of Finland, Alexander Stubb.
Thank you, very, very kind. Thank you for the introduction. You know, when we had penciled in this visit to London, I told my team that, you know, could I go to the LSE and give one of these sort of alumni speeches? Ah, great idea. What do you want to speak about, Mr. President? I said, I have a really good idea. I should speak about my PhD. Negotiating differentiated integration in the 1996-1997 Intergovernmental Conference was the title, to which my team responded, we also want an audience, so could you change the subject? It's really nice to see you here, and I'm also especially glad to see William and Helen Wallace. William was my, what do you call it? Supervisor at the time when I was writing this, and Helen was very much a big part of me starting writing about the subject of differentiated integration. But I'm not talking about that here today. I'm going to talk about the world order. And before I kick off, I was sort of this good news and bad news. So we have Finnish media here, and the Finnish media said I saw the headline, President giving lecture at a top university. So, you know, be happy, right? But the bad news is this sort of quenches any academic freedom that I thought I would have, so I have to sort of tone it down a little bit. What I'll do is I'm going to give you an introduction, and then I've changed tack a little bit. I'm going to give you 4 points, and then a conclusion to keep you on track. And the fourth point is actually a development of a book that I wrote a little while back called The Triangle of Power, Rebalancing the New World Order. And I was encouraged by a friend of mine to take this fourth point in. So it's a little bit of a risk, and my team is looking very worried here in the front. So what I'm talk about today is basically the world order and how I might see things changing. My big thesis today is that every so often a world order changes, and I think we are in one of those moments. My second thesis is that it's going to be the global south that decides what the next world order looks like. My third thesis is that if the West wants to have skin in the game, or at least save the remnants of the liberal world order, it needs to use something which I have called values-based realism. I'll develop it a little bit. And combined with dignified foreign policy. The final point I want to say in an introduction, I think the choice that we have in the New World Order now is fairly binary, but probably a bit more complex. And by that I mean to say that on one hand, you have a group of countries which believe in multipolarity, which is in essence spheres of interests, transactions, deals, and bilateral arrangements among the 200 nation states of the world. And then you have another group which believes in multilateralism, which is about international institutions, rules, norms, and cooperation. And this is kind of the choice that we are faced with right now. So here we go. First, a few words on order, then a few words on balance, then a few words on dynamics, and then finally I'll try to extrapolate it into what I think is going on in the US right now, and in Russia, and in Europe, and potentially in China. I'll be a little bit telegraphic because I want to leave some space for questions. First, on the order. So if you think about it, for your generation, you're living through what I would call a 1945 or 1989 moment. When I started studying in 1989, it was very much the end of the Cold War. We were seeing end of history. We believed that all 200 nation states of the world would revert to some kind of liberal democracy, globalization, and free markets. For you, it's a different value proposal, I'm afraid. But the order changed in 1918, after World War I. They created the League of Nations. It lasted for two decades. It wasn't strong enough. We ended up in World War II. 1945, San Francisco moment. After World War II, they created the current liberal world order, which was based on the UN, on the WTO, at the time GATT, on the IMF, and on the World Bank. So there were sort of rules, and there was a power balance. The ideological rivalry was between the Soviet Union and the United States and their allies. But the world was very much bipolar. And then, of course, in 1989, we thought that history ended and the rest is going to be about rainbows and peace signs and flowers and green fields and the rest of it. And to a certain extent, for a while, that world lasted and it was quite good. But I don't think it exists anymore. And that's why I'm saying that we went from a bipolar world, Soviet, US, to a unipolar world led by the US, and now very much a multipolar world where there are different types of players. And the big question that I think all of the students of international relations have to ask themselves, is this a rupture or a death of the old system, or is this a transition? This is where Mark Carney and I, we're actually going running tomorrow morning, so we can talk about it. The thinking is it a rupture, as Marx says, that, you know, let's just throw the baby out with the bathwater, or is it a transition? I belong to the transition category. And we'll see how it goes. So don't destroy the old order. It's just going to take a time for it to be crafted. My second thesis, and this is very much part of the book on my second point, is that I've called it the triangle of power. So I believe for a long time that we are kind of this battle of ideas where you have the global West led by the US, followed by Europe, Japan, South Korea, New Zealand, Australia. We want to preserve the multilateral liberal world order, right? Why? Because we crafted it. Because it's in our interests. And then on the other side, you have what I call the global East, led by China, followed by Russia, and roughly 25 countries that vote more or less with China and Russia in the UN. And then, I know it's unfair, but the third part of the triangle is the global South. It's unfair to put the 125 countries together, but my argument, as is Mark Carney's, that inside the global South, there are middle powers like India, Indonesia, many of the Gulf states, Nigeria, South Africa, Egypt, Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, and perhaps Turkey as well, that are going to decide the direction in which the world is going to tilt. Is it going to be this multipolar world led by China or this multilateral world led by the US? Well, of course, things have changed a little bit since the book was published or since I finished it. So now if I were to rewrite this book, I would probably call it The Rectangle of Power. And let me explain. So I would give the brand of the Global West to the US because it's focused on the Western Hemisphere. And I would take the ideological leadership of the what I used to call the Global West to something I call the Global North. But I'm a Nordic, so it doesn't, you know what I'm saying? I can't, it doesn't sound that good, and they're kind of just five Nordic countries, and you know, we're not that big. But the idea would be that you have a Global West, we don't know what the US will do, you have a Global North which tries to defend the current order, you have a Global East that wants to change it, and then the Global South that kind of decides the direction in which we go. But my basic point still holds. I think it's the Global South that decides, you know, am I going to go with the Americans, with the Europeans, with China, with Russia? They have the agency in a way in which we haven't seen in recent world history. And then we come to my third point, which is the dynamics. And why do we need to even talk about this? Well, my big worry is that if we live in a world which is sort of Hobbesian or dog-eats-dog or, you know, transactional, we're not going to get results because the world is, number one, competitive. We have technological competition. We have geopolitical competition. We have energy competition, etc., etc. And if we don't cooperate on these things, it's going to spill over to the second point, which is conflict. And what your generation is now seeing as you are students of international relations or other things is an increase of conflict. Because after the Cold War, conflicts were, yes, there, but they were local. Now they're regional. Israel-Palestine. Israel-US-Iran. Iran-Gulf States. Russia-Ukraine. Sudan. So we're starting to see the effects of a world without rules. And my argument is that if we don't contain competition, it will spill over to conflict. Therefore, we need cooperation. And we can't be in a world where we're trying to solve climate change, which is completely on the back burner right now, where we try to take care of sustainability, where we have artificial intelligence, which is basically going to change not only the economy, the way in which we work, politics, the way in which we communicate, the war in the way in which we conduct it, and science in the way in which we are human beings. And an AI world without rules, you can't do that. You can't do that locally. And of course, with energy as well. So my argument is that we need to start getting back on the track of cooperation. And here's where I'm now going on thin ice. Encouraged by a friend of mine, tried to develop the thesis a little bit. My fourth point, always in foreign policy, deal with the world as it is. Do not deal with the world as you wish it would be. I know it's complicated, but let me try. My starting point for this whole book was Russia's war of aggression in February 2022. And my argument was that this was the first time that a permanent member of the UN Security Council goes for a full on-scale war of aggression on its neighbor at a scale in which we have not seen, and which violated every and each bit of the UN Charter. Now, don't get me wrong, the US has done it before, others has done it before, but this was just of a scale which, you know, we hadn't seen. So that ignited the whole idea of the book. But that now combined with the new US administration has taken it to a next level. So we had the actual cause, the original sin, which was Russia's attack on Ukraine, and then we had the accelerator, which is the US. If this is the case, what do we need to do? Number one, try to understand what America is doing. And for that, read the national security strategy of the US from November 2022. And what you'll find there is basically two strands of thinking. One is ideological, and that's MAGA, so Make America Great Again. That is very anti-globalization, anti-global institutions, including the ICC, the WHO. It's anti-EU, it's anti-woke, for a better lack of a term, and it basically sees the European Union as a big social democratic party, right? I mean, that's the sort of MAGA ideology. So understand that that's one strand of their thinking. Secondly, there's something that is called America First, and that's kind of the policy of the US. And in that policy, it has a pecking order. Number one is the Western Hemisphere. That's why you see things happening in Venezuela, in Colombia. You see things happening in Cuba. You know, you might like it, you might not, but that's their focus. Second is the Indo-Pacific. Number three in the pecking order is Europe. Number four only is the Middle East. And then number five is Africa. Of course, now with the war in Iran, which I'm sure we're going to discuss, things might have changed. But this is the thinking. So deal with America as it is, not as you wish it would be. I'm trying to be very pragmatic. So I admit that there are things with which we disagree with the US, like climate change or international cooperation or tariffs. But at the same time, you know, deal with the US in areas where it's useful, like defense or NATO, just Ukraine, for example. Secondly, if Trump was, and the US was, the accelerator, how about Russia? How are things looking for Russia 4 years after the war began? I would argue that not too well. Why? Because the strategic aim of Russia was to destroy Ukraine and make it Russia. Well, Ukraine is becoming European. The strategic aim of Russia was to prevent NATO from enlarging. They ended up getting Finland and Sweden, which would have not joined had Russia not attacked. And thirdly, the aim was to make European defense as weak as possible, and now we're standing at 5% of defense expenditure. So strategically, a failure. And then you have to ask yourself the question, in 4 years, with over 1 million dead or wounded, most of them Russian, has this been a successful special operation? Well, the answer to that is probably no. It started as a conventional war, almost like tanks and trenches and World War I. Now it has gone into a technological war where the upper hand is actually with the Ukrainians. And sorry for bringing these figures in here. I know they're uncomfortable. But in the past 3 months, the Ukrainians have killed somewhere between 30 to 35,000 Russian soldiers, 80% of which were killed with drones. They're not able to recruit as many as die. And if you compare that, say 90,000 plus in 3 months, compare that to Soviet war in Afghanistan, which lasted 10 years, 18,000 dead. You can see the scale of tragedy and atrocity that we're dealing with. And on top of that, if you look at Russia's position in the world, did they succeed with Syria? No, regime change. Were they able to do anything on Venezuela? No. Were they able to do anything on Iran? No. So, you know, we are, well, you're tilting your head a little bit. We can have a discussion about how they succeeded on that, but did they really? So, you know, what we're seeing, or on Cuba. So what we're seeing actually is a weaker Russia, which is quite dependent on China right now. And then we go to where we are now, Europe and the UK. Let me, for the sake of argument, forget Brexit and EU. I know this is difficult. Sorry. Yeah, but not only because of tuition fees, but see, LSE students know their place, so it's good. Here, I actually, by the way, as president, you don't need to study the Finnish Constitution, Article 93, but the president is in charge of foreign policy and he's the commander-in-chief. He doesn't do the EU or domestic policy, right? So that's why I don't sit in the EU summits, the prime minister does. But for me, I don't differentiate between leaders such as Starmer, Macron, and Merz as heads of government of their countries, because I only focus on NATO, the UN, war in Ukraine, Iran, and so for me, they are the same. So let's put them together. Now, strangely enough, I feel that, and again, trying to develop the thinking of the book, what has happened with this Russia, in other words, security pressure from the East, and the US transatlantic pressure in the relationship. This has brought Europe closer than ever. And I know we see a lot of noise on, you know, disagreeing Hungary on sanctions, etc. But I've never, you know, I'm an EU nerd, right? I mean, William and Helen know this. I'm a real EU nerd. So I've never seen the EU more united than it is right now. Of course, it's not going to last. You know, it's 27 countries and the rest of it. But the bottom line is that we've been able to sort of pull together because we're squeezed between the East and the West. And then on top of that, interestingly enough, if you think about it, when I was studying at the LSE, it was all about interdependence, about technology, about information, about value chains, etc., etc. Those are the instruments of power that are now being used also as instruments of war. And the EU has exclusive competence on trade, so it can play that game. It has exclusive competence on monetary policy, it can play that game. It has exclusive competence on customs, it can play that game. And it has exclusive competence on competition, so it can play that game. So we live in a different kind of world where hard power and military is there, but some of the instruments that the EU have are still quite strong. And then my final point in trying to sort of develop the book a little bit before I conclude is to say on China, isn't it interesting that China right now looks like a patient, stable, and predictable power? You know, one with which you can work, which doesn't come with surprises, which doesn't come right or wrong with a moral high ground. China used to have something that was called wolf warrior diplomacy, where there was quite aggressive Chinese diplomats. That's out of the window now. Quite the contrary. You create a lot of path dependencies between countries from the global south, also the global west, global north, with China. So it looks like a predictable partner. So all of these things are now shifting. And here I haven't even begun a discussion on, you know, where's India's place in this? How about the Gulf region? How about the African Union? How about Latin America? So there are a lot of things going on. And here's where I come to my conclusion on a little bit over time, I'm sorry. Number one, I think we live in a world disorder. So if I was now a PhD student at the LSE, I'd find it fascinating and I'd certainly focus my PhD on trying to make sense of what's going on. Number two, we're seeing a whole bunch of power vacuums. And whenever there's a power vacuum, someone is going to fill it. So when the UN is not allowed to do peace mediation, it's going to become transactional. And you start getting these really interesting unholy alliances of countries with different types of interests and proxies playing a game. Number three, I think multilateralism is not dead, but in order for us to save it, we need to rebalance the power structure of the UN, of the international institutions. Because if you don't do that, and if those institutions are basically created in the image of the West, then the global South is not going to work with them. Number four, I think it'll be 5 years before the system settles. So if you're a slow writer, you know, you're okay. If you're a quick writer, do some predictions. And then my final point is one sort of development that I did in a speech in New Delhi 2 weeks ago. I think what we need is like a new San Francisco moment or a new Bretton Woods moment where world leaders come together, say 200, in, I call it the New Delhi moment, you know, do it in India, which is, you know, the up and coming, and then try to figure out, you know, what are the institutions that we need to do to preserve, work with to preserve peace? Who does the peace mediation? What is the power structure of the financial institutions and how do we deal with it? Is this idealistic? Perhaps a little bit, but I think it's at least worth a try. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, for these fascinating remarks. If I may, I'd like to start with a question before opening up to the audience. And given your own journey between academia, European institutions, and now the presidency, what do you think is the role that universities could play in helping societies navigate this era of fragmentation?
Yeah, I mean, obviously huge, and I don't say this only because I'm in a university, but I think we're all prisoners of our own identity. I was never supposed to be an academic. I wanted to be something completely different, but then I was sort of awakened to things academic in the US and didn't look back ever since. For me, the role of universities is, first of all, to provide the raw material for analysis. And I only speak now as a social scientist and, you know, someone focused on IR rather than the hard sciences. Secondly, I think the role is to challenge. I don't mind at all, activism in terms of challenging traditional norms. And then the third thing I always want to tell students is that I think there's nothing wrong for you to oscillate between different careers. You know, I'm of a completely different generation than you guys are. But the truth is that your careers are going to be very diverse. So if you have your mindset on only one thing right now and your life expectancy is 110, you know, it's going to get boring at some stage. So what I'm trying to say is that try to work on different things and just find your thing and find where it's meaning. But the final point I want to make, what always drove me and what I was taught at university by the likes of Helen and William is this sort of innate curiosity. That be open, you know, don't become cynical, because that closes your mind in a way in which it's not going to develop anymore. And I think that's the role of university.
Thank you very much. I will open the floor to questions from the audience now. Please raise your hand and wait for the microphone.
He was the one that shook his head when I was speaking about it. So that's fine, just give it to him.
Yeah, and please keep it short so we can hear from as many of you as possible. And please state your name and your department or program. Yeah.
With two at a time, was it?
Two at a time. We'll do two at a time, yeah.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm a teaching philosophy here at LSE. I had a question. Trump, in FT reported, threatened NATO allies if they're not going to come, begging them to come to assist in opening the Strait of Hormuz, saying that I think it will be very bad for the future of NATO if they don't come into assistance. And then UK, Germany, Sweden, Finland today all basically said, well, we're not going to come to assistance. So in addition to the economic impact, the military impact, now with this diplomatic, shall we say, friction, how do you see the war in Iran impacting the Euro-Atlantic relationships, maybe with reference to kind of the good, the bad, the ugly possible scenarios?
Yeah.
Thank you. One more question. Here at the front, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. Thank you for your speech. Before coming to this speech, I have watched your address and Resina dialogue in New Delhi.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Besides recognizing the rise of Global South, you also endorsed Mark Carney's call for the middle powers to unite. Mm-hmm. So my question is a practical one. In your view, what are the specific institutions and the mechanisms can these middle powers use to coordinate, and to what extent can such a coalition actually restore the rules-based international order, given that the current order is still dominated by the permanent members of UN Security Council? Thank you.
Yeah. Two, I think, really, really good questions. So the Finnish media, when they said top university, they are right. So on the first one, President Trump threatening NATO allies if they don't pitch in on Iran. I think probably a starting point is to look at what was the projection of American power in Libya, in Iraq, or in Afghanistan. In those particular cases, the US was very much a hegemon, but at the same time, it consulted two avenues. The first one was international institutions or the UN, so it tried to get a UN Security Council resolution on it. Failing that, it consulted allies. On Iraq, I think there were 49, if I recall correctly. Afghanistan was broader and there were NATO missions, et cetera, et cetera. This time around, the US didn't do any of that. So I think that's the big difference. If you don't consult partners in advance or tell them that something is going to happen, the approach is going to be different. Now, what would I then do in this situation? I would try to go for the India / Jai Shankar approach, which was in the same FT. And that approach is basically to go for some form of peace mediation. I think what we need to do now in that war is to de-escalate. Because I just don't see the US wanting to end the war or Iran wanting to end the war. So now we need to get, and Israel is a different case in this. It has different interests, I think, from the US. So I would want to de-escalate. What does this mean to NATO? I think we have to wait. I don't want to rush into conclusions from, you know, one statement. But from what I understand, the president's idea is that if you don't help us in Iran, why should I help you on NATO? Now, I think we need to try to, again, engage and convince why it is important for the United States to stay engaged in NATO. And of course, if you reverse it, you just say, well, why do you want European help? Well, because Europeans have bases that you can use. Europeans have equipment that you can use. So they are your allies. And you know, alliances bring also responsibilities of behavior. But yes, I think your analysis of the pattern from E3, so Germany, France, the UK, and then, you know, Nordics as well is an understandable. Again, I come from a small country. We don't have the type of equipment that can be sent to the region. And in any case, our job in the alliance is to take care of the northeastern part of Europe. Then on your question and the speech in Raisina, I didn't go into the details here, but my big thesis, and I've said it in a couple of UN speeches, if we want the UN Security Council to work, I would make three suggestions. The first one is that you double the membership of the UN Security Council, so you take one from Latin America, two from Africa, and two from Asia. I think India being an obvious one from Asia. Then secondly, you need to, and this is more idealistic, scrap veto power in the UN Security Council. I was on Restive Politics the other day, and we were talking about this with Alistair and Rory, and we were talking about the European seats, you know, France and the UK, and they, of course, challenged my premise here. I said, oh, so what do you want? You're going to give the British seat to Finland? But no, it didn't come. So, but I mean, we need to do something on that. And then thirdly, I would actually take away the voting powers of a UN Security Council member that violates the UN Charter. You know, these might be idealistic, but again, I come back to the point that that UN Security Council was built in the 1940s, then with the addition of China in what, 1973 or something like that. It could have been a little bit later. So, you know, China came in at a certain time. Why can't we bring in more states coming in? So that would be the sort of starting point. We just need to start a conversation on this.
Thank you very much. We'll take two more questions. There was a woman at the back. Yes, right at the back.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, for coming here. I'm a PhD candidate at the European Institute, and I teach EU politics and institutions. And I'm terribly sorry to prove your team wrong, but I would actually talk about your PhD, and someone actually
does
read it.
You can come to Chatham House tomorrow. We have a couple of seats available. I'm giving that talk there.
I would love to. Yeah. This concept of flexible differentiation, you've wrote about it at the end of the 90s, but now it's coming to the forefront of the discussion in the European public sphere. Mario Draghi speaks about flexible, pragmatic federalism. Mm. And even in Brussels, the talk of a second-tier membership for Ukraine is seeming more and more concrete. So my question to you is, what do you think is the role of flexible differentiation in the EU, especially in a world order that is less united, more fragmented, more complex? Is it more suited than just like a unity reflex and uniform integration in this sense.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks. Question here at the front.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. My name is Dominic Chasser. I'm a first-year politics and international relations student. My question would be that, how do you feel about a multi-speed European Union? There has been talks about it in Davos and in Munich, and like the E6 between the largest European economies. You said that Europe is more united than ever. Wouldn't a multi-speed Europe make some states feel disillusioned in the European project? There are still some states that are looking to integrate as the West. I'm primarily referring towards the Eastern European countries, such as Hungary and Slovakia. Wouldn't you feel that a two-tier speed Europe would disillusion such states? Thank you.
Yeah, my supervisors are smiling in the front there. They're so happy. Look, our son gets to talk about his PhD kind of thing. No, I think if I can lump both of the questions together. So tomorrow I am giving a speech at Chatham House. And I actually wrote that speech down. So it's typed up on my way from India. And it became a little bit almost sort of anecdotal and historical and a walk down memory lane of my PhD. So where would I take it now? I'd look at it from two angles. The first one is, what do you do inside the European Union when you're 27 member states? We've always had differentiation or flexibility within the system, so there's kind of nothing new with that. And I think we need to increase the use of that instrument. You'll remember that we put it into the Amsterdam Treaty, then we revised it in Nice and in Lisbon. And it has a set of conditions. So for those of you who don't do differentiated integration, it basically means that not every EU member state needs to do the same thing at the same time. And then in the 1990s, there was this cacophony of terminology, multi-speed, variable geometry, a la carte, hardcore, multi-tier, just, you know, endless. So what I did was to categorize them into three. So multi-speed is something where you have the same aim, but you reach it at a different time. I'd have no problem with that. Variable geometry means that some countries can forge ahead without everyone going, like Schengen or the Euro. And then a la carte means that you can kind of pick and choose which areas you want to do. It's a bit more dangerous, but with an EU of 27, I don't mind. So what I'm trying to say is that increase flexibility. I think that's a good idea. And then the second tack is for the outside. Now, we're 27 member states. About 10 are knocking on the door right now. Yeah. And my idea is that we could start thinking about a different way. And this is just an intellectual construct so far, which is dangerous because I'm president. I'm not supposed to have them. I'm supposed to give up a clear position and vision. But my thinking is that perhaps we should start having even more variable memberships inside the EU. And there has been talk about a reversed accession, which is not flying very well with the member states right now. And there the idea is that on Ukraine, for instance, you bring them in as a member, and then you start giving them the sort of membership goodies as they go along. And I don't have an answer for it, but I do think that we are going to have more direct. So the UK is a good example. Okay, my take on the UK. So, and I'm completely subjective on this. I think Brexit was obviously a huge mistake. One of the biggest that we've seen in recent history. My sort of tongue-in-cheek comment is that it took you 7 years to negotiate out. It'll take you 7 years to regret, and then another 7 years to get in. Whether that will happen or not, I don't know. But here we need to be super pragmatic. So start working with the UK on security, on intelligence, on defense, on energy, and then push it, be functional and pragmatic, and then at the end of the day it'll come. So I think my basic point is very simple. We need more flexibility both inside Europe and outside Europe.
Thank you very much. We'll take two more questions. Trying to see if there's a woman here, a woman in the middle there, please.
Hi. Hi, my name is Patrice. I am currently an environment and development student here, and I am from the Philippines. And this year marks the 71st anniversary of diplomatic relations between Finland and the Philippines. And at a time when multilateral
Finland
institutions...
Finland and who?
Sorry?
Finland and who?
The Philippines.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes. Good. 70...
And at the time when multilateral institutions like the UN face increasing skepticism, how can partnerships between countries like Finland and the Philippines help strengthen trust in the multilateral system? Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, Professor Featherstone there.
This is dangerous. I used to read his books. Hi, nice to see you.
And I read yours as well, so thank you. Just briefly, I wonder how you would respond to two upcoming scenarios. Scenario number one, in a little over a year's time, France might elect Marine Le Pen or Jordan Bardella as president. Is that an existential moment for European unity? Mm-hmm. Secondly, this year we have the midterm elections, and the Democrats might advance in Congress. In any event, in little over 2 years' time, we would be dealing with Trump's successor. Those two scenarios, how do they affect your argument, please?
I like student questions better. Okay, so first to Patrice. Finland, Philippines, I think the key there is to understand Finland is a small power, Philippines is a middle power. We need to, again, come back to the notion of giving the Philippines and countries like Philippines more agency and power in international institutions. So in many ways, I can only be a facilitator, and then the power grab has to come from Philippines itself. I also believe, and which I didn't say here, I really believe in regional integration. I believe that regional integration is the best laboratory for global cooperation. So that's why I like the EU. I'm an EU nerd. That's why I like ASEAN. You know, I like the African Union. I like Mercosur. So that would be my encouragement. Work with the regional stuff and then elevate it up to a global stuff would be my sort of point on that. And then Professor Featherstone, it's not very nice of you to ask, you know, President two scenarios. Because when the journalists ask me, I always say, well, you know, we have scenarios, but we don't try to predict the future. But I'll just give you an example. So the first one was the French presidential elections. Now, there are, of course, two ways to deal with right-wing nationalism, if that's the right term for Front National or anyone else. One is you can embrace it and give power and deal with it. The other one is that you reject it. And you have countries, of course, which have rejected any kind of cooperation with right-wing parties. And then you have countries who have allowed it or embraced it. And it just depends on the policy. Is it a defining moment? I don't think so. Because when you come into power and you're France, even if you're a French nationalist, you ask yourself, what is in the interest of France? It's probably to try to lead Europe, right? So that's why I say that, you know, and I'll give you another example, Giorgia Meloni. You know, a lot of people were afraid when she came in that, you know, right-wing, and she's been a really strong, I would say, pro-European voice. You might disagree with their policies on immigration. You might disagree with their policies on equality or on abortion. But she's been very strong, I think, in Europe and played a super important role. So the jury's out on that. Then scenario number two on the US midterms, I think we're all waiting for that. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, of course, ideologically, there are people that wish the Democrats would win. There are ideologically the people that feel that the Republicans would win. But when I ask my American friends for an educated guess, they say the House goes to... the Democrats and the Senate remains in the hands of the Republicans. But we simply don't know. But of course, this will then have an impact on the capacity of Trump's administration to push forward the policy agenda which they have driven. So I can't give you an answer, but this is just a guess.
Okay, we have 3 minutes, so there's only a very quick question. Right at the back. Please be quick in your questions, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm Juan David Naranjo from Colombia, and I wanted to ask you about what you mentioned, that Europe has increased their budget for defense. And I know you said that you believe we need to talk about values-based realism, but I wanted to know if you feel proud of increasing that budget, if you feel that is a good thing that is happening now, or if you just believe that is a bad thing that is happening and we just need to deal with it and grieve it in a way.
It's a really good question.
And final one here.
Hi, my name is Josephine, and I'm from the Department of Management. So my question is, regarding AI and artificial intelligence, do you think it has the potential to reshape the world order like nuclear technology did? And I'm not even talking just about countries. Maybe countries may be ending up as secondary actors in the long run. It may even shift power to the hands of multinational corporations. So,
good. Two different questions, but a little bit related. So first two, on the European defense budget, do I feel proud about it? I don't look at it from that perspective. I think we are in a situation where defense budgets globally, but especially in Europe, are on the increase. And the reason for that is Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine and the security threat of Russia. Finland is slightly odd out in the sense that we maintained our military capabilities even when the Cold War ended, because we joined the EU but did not join NATO. And we had had our experience from the Winter War and the War of Continuation, not a dissimilar experience to what Ukraine has right now. So that meant that we still continued to have conscription. So all males are obliged to do military service, and women do it voluntarily. This means that we have 1 million men and women out of 5.6 that have done their military service. This meant that we still have a very strong air force with over 60 F-18s and just bought 64 F-35s, which were quite expensive and keep our defense expenditure up. It means that we have long-range missiles, air, sea, and land, and it means that we have the biggest artillery in Europe together with Poland. And as I always say, we don't have them because we're worried about Sweden, right? So am I proud that the budget has gone up? No, but I'm proud that we have one of the largest militaries in Europe together with Turkey, Ukraine, and Poland. Proud is the wrong word, but I feel much better that we have that because it's a deterrent. Would I much rather spend the money on social security, on education? Yes, I would. But reality is that we can't afford to do that right now. So that's why we've gone up. I hope we would live in a world where we didn't have to do that. Of course, historically, defense expenditure is quite low if you go 100 years back or 200 years back. But the reason we have prospered as societies is that we didn't have to spend so much on defense. We could spend it on other things, which then, I think, improve the condition of mankind. Then, Josephine, on AI, will it shape the world order? The short answer is yes. And funnily enough, when I started writing this book 5-6 years ago, when I had sort of, because I left politics and I was never supposed to come back, I was in academia. And I thought that, you know, I started reading a lot on tech and AI and the rest of it. And I thought, okay, now I have an idea for a book. And I even have a 60-page outline for it. And the book is called Digital Democracy or Digital Dictatorship. So I tried to understand, you know, is technology only for good or can it be used for bad as well? And how will this craft? If you take it to the geopolitical context, yes. I think Putin was right when he said that the one that rules AI will rule the world. There is a clear race on AI between the US, between China, between Europe, and India, for that matter. And then you come to the question, okay, who is the one that is going to come on top? I think the one that comes on top is the one that doesn't look backwards, that understands that quantum is going to be the infrastructure for AI, that networks are the basis of trustworthy AI. So the ones that have the cutting edge in that are going to do quite well. But, you know, it will change, and you can already see it. It changes warfare. So I guess the good news is that we could be moving towards warfare where the collateral damage is machine to machine rather than human to human. But right now, if you look at the way in which weapons have been used against humans and civilian targets, you might, you know, give a counter-argument that that doesn't happen. But I think with the reshaping of the world order, and this is probably my final point, I think it would be really important that we found common rules to artificial intelligence and biotech, because we are, and you don't want to sound too much like Harari here, I'm a huge fan, but you know, his thesis that AI is the first technology that has agency, that you know, the combination of biology and technology, and CRISPR technology especially, and the chance for us as human beings to change our DNA sequencing, they're fundamental questions about what it means to be a human being. And if we don't have common rules on this, I think we're in trouble. And that's the sad thing right now with the disorder where I started, that just at a time when we really, really need the cooperation on climate change and on AI. So what are we focusing on? We're focusing on weapons, you know, how we can kill each other rather than how we can advance technology for the good of mankind. But I want to leave you with a positive note. You know, I've always believed in the rationality of human beings to find common solutions to common problems, to overcome difficult situations. As mankind, we have developed throughout, and we are in a much better place now than we were, say, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And I see no reason for us that we're not in a better place once we get this new world order in the next 5 years. I'll come and give another talk here.
Thank you so much, Mr. President, for these fantastic and really insightful reflections at such a pivotal moment for the world. I think I share the view in the room that this has been a fantastic opportunity to hear from President Alexander Stubbs, and I would like you all to join me in thanking Mr. President.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.